And it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you, along with Bonnie Berman. Well, this hour we visit with Dr. Sarah Gottfried and discuss her longtime studies and practice with female hormones. She's the author of The Hormone Cure, Reclaim Balance, Sleep, Sex Drive, and Vitality Naturally. And Dr. Sarah Gottfried joins us now from San Francisco's public radio station, KQED. Welcome to you, Doctor.
Thank you, Joseph. So happy to be with you.
And welcome, Doctor. Great to have you. Why don't we
Thank you, Bonnie.
Why don't we begin with you and your own experience when you were in your 30s? What was going on in all aspects of your life?
I was a bit of a train wreck in my 30s. I was working in McMedicine. I had two kids, and I was doing what many women do in that age range. I was burning the candle at both ends. I had premenstrual syndrome, low sex drive, and a lot of stress.
What is McMedicine?
McMedicine, I'm basically referring to taking care of a lot of patients each day. I was working at the local health maintenance organization, seeing about 30 patients a day, performing hysterectomies, and then delivering babies at night. So I was really very busy with the work that I was doing as a working mom.
And so what was going on hormonally for you?
Well, I went to see my local physician. This is what many women do. And I got offered an antidepressant. And that just felt wrong to me, Bonnie, because I didn't feel depressed. I felt like a stress case. But as I looked at that prescription, I was offered Prozac and also a birth control pill. I had a defining moment because I just realized we are treating these problems with exactly the wrong things. And so I had a hunch that I had a problem with my hormones, and it turns out that was exactly the case. I had very high cortisol. Cortisol is that stress hormone that you want in the Goldilocks position, not too high, not too low. I also had a slow thyroid, and it made me, the combination of the high cortisol and low thyroid, it made me fat, frazzled, frumpy, and just really feeling too young to feel so old.
You know, it's interesting. I want to get back to, of course, we're going to talk about cortisol and thyroid and all those things, but we usually think of hormone problems in later years, but you were only in your 30s. So when should women begin to look at their hormone levels, and which ones would those be?
Well, I really believe that it's never too early and it's never too late to look at your hormone issues. And the way that I look at hormones and the way that they crosstalk, what that means is that you want to start paying attention to hormones really in adolescence, definitely in your 20s. Mm. You will begin to fall down a hormonal flight of stairs in your 30s unless you start to get attentive about these hormones. The main ones to pay attention to as a woman are what I call the hormonal Charlie's Angels: cortisol, estrogen, and thyroid. We even have science now showing that in utero, these hormones can affect you. In fact, they can shorten your telomeres, which are those cute little caps on your chromosomes that help to stabilize your chromosomes and appear to be one of the best biological markers of how you're aging, you know, not chronologically, but in terms of how fast you're aging.
Telomeres. Tell us more about them and what affects them.
So telomeres are something that was made famous by Elizabeth Blackburn, who's a biochemist at UCSF. She got the Nobel Prize in 2009 with a couple of other folks for her work on telomeres. And she started out by looking at women who were premenopausal, so looking at women in their 20s, 30s, and 40s, who had a sick child. And then she compared those women to a control group, a group of women that had a child who was healthy. She found that the women with the highest perceived stress, with the highest cortisol, had the shortest telomeres. You want your telomeres to be long and lovely because they basically tell you about your longevity. They tell you how fast you're aging. So telomeres are really important. We know that cortisol and high stress impacts the length of your telomeres, makes them short and stubby, which we don't want.
So how do we get tested to know how long our telomeres are?
Well, there's a couple of labs that will test your telomeres. We're still trying to decide if this is ready for prime time, but it's an example of how we're moving in the direction of personalized medicine. We're moving in the direction of, you know, how is it that you're living your life? How do you construct your dashboard and really measure the things that are going to make the biggest impact on the way that you live your life, how long you live your life and how well, how much energy you have, how good your mood is, your sex drive, etc.
So you say that stress has hijacked our hormone balance. What do you mean by that? Just how important is just everyday stress in our hormone imbalance?
Well, I really believe that we've got a modern plague of overwhelmed women and that the problem is hormonal, and yet most people don't know it. What I find in my practice is that up to 91% of the women that I work with struggle with their energy. They feel tired but wired. They have difficulty with sleep. They feel like their mood is not where they want it to be. So I believe that when you're not dancing with stress in a way that really suits you, chances are your cortisol is either too high or too low, perhaps even both within the same day. When that happens, it hijacks your other hormones. It can make your thyroid slow down. It can block your progesterone receptor. Progesterone is that lovely hormone that acts like nature's Valium. So we need it to feel soothed. And I find that so many women are struggling with stress. Now, stress itself is not such a bad thing. It's more our response to stress. For people with the highest perceived stress who are running task to task, that's where you start to have problems with cortisol.
Are there genetic grounds for hormone imbalance? If your mother had it, are you likely to?
There's definitely genetic grounds. You know, this is part of that future of medicine. I think our healthcare system right now is really broken, and we're going in the direction of personalized medicine, where we understand both your DNA and also how you impact your DNA with the way that you eat, move, think, and supplement. So yes, there are genetic grounds. An example of this is something called the short serotonin transporter gene. Now, that's a bit of a mouthful, but serotonin is that lovely, happy brain chemical that is responsible for mood, sleep, and appetite. So you want to have serotonin in a good place in your brain. It's a big part of really feeling vital and energized and happy. And people who have the short serotonin gene are more likely to have difficulty moving serotonin around their brain. And they also have something called cortisol resistance, which is where their cells become numb to the stress hormone cortisol. Probably our listeners have heard of insulin resistance, which is where your cells become numb to insulin. And it's a fat storage hormone, so you tend to put on weight when you're insulin resistant. You can be resistant to other hormones as well, including cortisol.
When you were talking about serotonin, so of course we have these SSRIs, the serotonin reuptake inhibitors that are prescribed. Do you think antidepressants are being overprescribed? And maybe some people really need them if they have that gene.
Well, I definitely think that SSRIs are overprescribed. What we know from the science, and I always go back to the science as a first response, we know from the science that really it's only when you have severe depression that a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor is indicated. So when you have severe depression, I really think it can be life-saving. The problem is that the majority of people who are taking antidepressants, including SSRIs, do not have severe depression.
What constitutes severe depression?
Right.
Well, severe depression is a much more overwhelming series of symptoms that have been lasting for more than 2 weeks. And there's a long list of criteria that psychiatrists and primary care doctors use to make a diagnosis of severe depression. It includes difficulty with sleep, difficulty with appetite, not having your sense of joy with the things that you do each day, something called psychomotor retardation, which is where you have inertia, like it's hard to move. So what I find is that the majority of people are taking antidepressants with mild to moderate symptoms. But here's a statistic for you. We know that 1 in 4 women between the ages of 40 and 59 is taking an antidepressant. Now, very few of those actually have severe depression. And here's what happens. When you're taking an antidepressant, we know that there's an increased risk of breast and ovarian cancer. There's weight gain. There's an increased risk of stroke. The list is pretty long of what can happen when you're taking an antidepressant. Maybe even more important is that you're not treating the root cause. So if we go back to hormones, hormones drive what you're interested in. We know that 50% of people with depression have high cortisol. 20% of people with depression have a slow thyroid. And yet many folks in the U.S. are started on an antidepressant without getting these hormones tested. So that's where I really want to change the conversation we're having about hormones.
How do we get doctors to give us these tests? Are they reluctant to test people for these things before prescribing antidepressants?
Well, I think there's some doctors who are aware of this, who will test your thyroid before starting an antidepressant, or who will hold out for a diagnosis of severe depression before prescribing an antidepressant. But I would say what really separates conventional medicine from a more alternative approach, or even looking at root causes, is cortisol. So I was trained in conventional medicine. I went through Harvard Medical School. I did my residency training at UCSF. And I was not taught to test for cortisol in someone who's depressed. So it's not so much that it's this, willfulness to not test women or men for their hormones when they come in with depression symptoms. It's more that there's a lack of awareness.
We need to take a break, and when we come back, I'd like to ask you about cortisol levels in men, because we are focusing on women mostly, but I'm sure they're affected too. We're talking to Dr. Sarah Gottfried. She's a Harvard and MIT-trained integrative physician, scientist, gynecologist, and yoga teacher. The name of the book, The Hormone Cure, Reclaim Balanced Sleep, Sex Drive, and Vitality Naturally. It's Topical Currents. We'll be right back.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Dr. Sarah Gottfried. We're talking about the hormone cure. If you'd like to call in with a comment or question, that's easy enough. 1-800-743-WLRN. 1-800-743-9576. Also email, that's radio@WLRN.org. radio@WLRN.org.
So, Dr. Gottfried, tell us about cortisol levels in men, high cortisol levels or low cortisol levels in men.
Cortisol in men is still very important. You know, I talk about the hormonal Charlie's Angels in women, your cortisol, estrogen, and thyroid levels. And in men, I think about it as the three amigos. So these are the three hormones you want to pay attention to if you're a guy. Cortisol, testosterone, and thyroid. But when it comes to stress and how men deal with cortisol levels, we know that stress favors men. Cortisol is more regulated. It's not as up and down as it is in women. We know from research going back to the 1930s that men under stress tend to go into fight or flight. And that research was done in men and assumed to apply to women. So there's actually some subtle differences between how men and women deal with stress. And I think most people can relate to this. Women have more drama when it comes to cortisol. Our control system gets more wonky. It affects our ovaries more. It slows down our thyroid function. It's almost as if women under stress send a text message to their thyroid to slow down. A tiger is chasing you. We send a text message to our ovaries to stop making so many sex hormones, and that can affect your sex drive as well as your ability to lose weight. So there's definitely more drama, more variability with cortisol levels in women compared to men.
And so other than stress, what else would make for a high cortisol level in women?
Well, there's lots of different types of stress other than just the day-to-day living and our modern hurry-up lives. There's also food. You know, I talk quite a bit about how you can balance your hormones with the way you eat, move, think, and supplement. And it turns out that you can change 50 to 80% of your DNA with those things, with how you eat, move, think, and supplement. So what else causes high cortisol? Well, if you have food intolerances, that can raise your cortisol level. So, for instance, I have an intolerance to gluten and also to dairy. That leads to high cortisol if I eat those foods. So this is an example of food as information. You want to reduce the amount of cortisol and stress in your body. You want to reduce the amount of inflammation, because inflammation is really that final common pathway that leads to disease, cancer, degenerative changes.
Okay. What else? I noticed you're not a coffee advocate, and it's been proven to have so many benefits in recent years. Why do you think it's so bad? Does it also raise cortisol levels?
Coffee definitely raises cortisol levels. Alcohol raises cortisol levels. And it's not that I'm saying everyone must abstain from coffee. Here's what I'm saying about coffee. I'm saying, are you using it medicinally? I think that's a very important question. If you wake up in the morning and you feel exhausted and all you can think about is making yourself a cup of coffee, you are taking out a high interest loan against your adrenal glands, those cute little glands in your mid-back that secrete cortisol and other sex hormones. So I think it's important that we use real sources of energy, not fake sources of energy. So coffee can be effective. You're right, there's mixed data. There's some data showing that it's beneficial. But for people who have high cortisol, especially in the morning, I don't think a cup of coffee is in your best interest.
That would be a hard one. But so, okay, so to get our cortisol levels tested, we go to our GP and we say we want a test of our cortisol levels?
Well, I'm a big fan of collaborating with your local physician. I think that's very important. I also have a quiz that we can offer to our listeners so that they can test and see if they have a problem with cortisol or with estrogen or thyroid. I also, in my book, in Chapter 1, have a more complete questionnaire that I use in my clients. And you can test these things. So you can definitely work with your local physician, ask them to do a morning cortisol level. That's really when it's most regulated. You can also do saliva testing. You don't need a doctor for that. I've got many of the labs listed in my book for how you can do that in the appendix. When you do a saliva test, often we do a four-point saliva test where you measure it before breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and before you go to bed.
Okay. Hmm. And that questionnaire you have at the beginning, I mean, it's so precise. I mean, it's so detailed. Aren't most of us going to answer yes to a lot of those questions?
Well, I have to tell you, Bonnie, I have a number of people who've done the questionnaire and do not have a yes answer to that, you know, list of 122 questions.
Only
so
122.
Those I put into the camp, 122. So
yes.
I would put those people into the camp of ideal hormonal specimens. If you have five or more yeses in my questionnaire in Chapter 1, then you definitely want to go to the corresponding chapter and get to the Gottfried protocol, some of the treatments that can help you with the high cortisol or the low thyroid. Can I also mention the quiz for people who want to do it for
free?
Sure,
please do. Please do, and tell us your website while you're talking about that.
Sure. So the website is thehormonecurebook.com, and the quiz is thehormonecurebook.com/quiz. thehormonecurebook.com/quiz.
/quiz.
Okay. Let's take a call or two. We've got Donna. She's in Plantation. Hi there.
Hi, good afternoon. I just happened to tune in, and the guest is actually speaking on something that I've struggled with all my life. I was told, as I mentioned earlier, that I had thyroid problems at 16. I have a small goiter, almost not noticeable, but it's there. And had it checked, it's benign. I'm also insulin dependent. Where can I go at this point? Is there anything I can do? And I'm over 50.
Doctor?
Great question. So you've had thyroid issues since you were 16. You're
yes.
over 50 now. So it
mm-hmm.
sounds like you probably are in menopause, since the average age for menopause in the U.S. is 51.
Mm-hmm.
And you're insulin dependent. So you mm-hmm. have diabetes.
Right.
Do you have any symptoms of menopause, hot flashes, night sweats?
Oh, I'm almost thinking I'm over it.
You're over it. Well, that's fantastic.
It sort of like came and went.
Well, what I would recommend for you, Donna, you know, I think it's very important to look at the root cause of why you had thyroid problems at 16, and then also why is it that you've had an issue with diabetes. Mm-hmm. So I think we're much more likely to affect a cure if we know the root cause. Mm-hmm. So you probably have an issue with your adrenals. And I would wonder if you took the quiz at thehormonecurebook.com/quiz, what comes up for you around cortisol? Have you ever had your cortisol levels tested?
No. No.
Okay. So for someone who is in their 50s and is challenged with thyroid issues and also with diabetes, I think it's very important to take a look at adrenal function and take a look at these hormonal Charlie's Angels. So those, again, are your cortisol, your estrogen, your thyroid. So when it comes to your cortisol levels, they can cause you to have difficulty with your blood sugar. Mm-hmm. So cortisol has a couple of jobs in the body. It definitely raises your blood sugar. It also raises your blood pressure. And we would want to get your cortisol into the normal range, mm-hmm. not too high, not too low. That would help you improve your blood sugar. And it would also help you with the diabetes, with preventing the inflammation that can come with the diabetes. The other interesting part, I mentioned that there's crosstalk between these hormones.
Right.
And if you have an issue with either high cortisol or low cortisol, that can slow down your thyroid function. So when you correct your cortisol level, mm-hmm. sometimes people find that their thyroid operates more effectively.
Okay. Now, what is the range? What are we looking at? Low and high?
So I have many of the ranges listed in my book. Okay. Are you talking about cortisol or with thyroid?
Cortisol.
So what I like to see in the morning is I like to see a cortisol level between 10 and 15. I think that's the best time to measure it. Mm-hmm. That would be in the blood.
Okay.
Ideally measured around 8, 8:30 a.m.
Okay.
Is that for both genders?
That is for both genders.
It should be the same level for both.
That's right.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, thanks for your call, Donna.
Oh, thank you very much.
And take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We're speaking to, oh, by the way, doctor, what is your website? Is it saragottfriedmd.com?
That's right. That's my website.
And that's saragottfriedmd.com. Which is who we're speaking to about her book, The Hormone Cure, Reclaim Balance, Sleep, Sex Drive, and Vitality on Topical Currents. Another short break. We'll come back and take some more of your calls and your emails. And welcome back to today's Topical Currents Monday edition. We're speaking with Dr. Sarah Gottfried. She's written The Hormone Cure, Reclaim Balance, Sleep, Sex Drive, and Vitality Naturally with the Gottfried Protocol, which I'd like to ask you about. What is that? I know there are three steps. Can you tell us about them?
Yes. So the first step is that you address the lifestyle changes, the nutritional gaps that are leading to the hormone issues that you have. So, for instance, we just had a caller who was telling us about her thyroid, and copper, zinc, selenium, vitamin D, cortisol, those are all really important for your thyroid. So you need to make sure that all those nutritional gaps are filled in. Step two of the Gottfried Protocol is to take proven botanical therapies. So, for instance, if I have a woman with high cortisol, one of the proven botanical therapies is rhodiola. Rhodiola.
What is that?
Rhodiola is an adaptogen. It's an herb that's been used for many thousands of years to help people cope with stress. So it helps to get cortisol into that balanced place. You know, the cool thing about cortisol is it's a completely tangible hormone. You can manage it like you manage your 401k. So rhodiola is a supplement that helps you do that. It's an herb. And then the third step of the Gottfried Protocol is that if you're not able to resolve your symptoms, your difficulty with sleep, mood, weight, or just feeling premenstrual or like a stress case, the third step is bioidentical hormones, but at the lowest doses and for the shortest duration.
And what are bioidentical hormones?
Bioidentical hormones are exact replicas of the hormones that you've always made. So with our last caller, for instance, she's in menopause. If she were to take bioidentical hormones, it would probably involve some estrogen, the same estrogen that she made throughout her reproductive years, and also progesterone, possibly testosterone. Those are some examples of bioidentical hormones. So they're a natural version of hormones. They're different than the synthetic hormones that were proven in 2002 in the Women's Health Initiative to be dangerous and provocative in the female body.
Are you against prescribed hormones in all cases, or do some people need them?
Oh, I definitely think that prescribed hormones are often needed, especially when it comes to menopause.
Right.
You know, we were talking earlier about the short serotonin transporter gene. Turns out that 40 to 45% of Caucasians have this gene. And when they go through menopause, when estrogen starts to drop, they begin to feel hypervigilant. They have difficulty sleeping. They feel way more stressed out. And so that's a good example of someone who might benefit from going on estrogen. My point is that I think we need to look upstream. We need to look at how do we address the root causes before we have a knee-jerk response to go to a pharmaceutical. What I find is that 95% of the time, you're able to balance your hormones with the way you eat, move, think, and supplement, with step one and step two of the Gottfried protocol. And I think it's important to lay that groundwork, because then you don't need as much of the bioidentical hormones.
What do you mean by think?
Oh, well, I'm a yoga teacher, so I really think that part of what we need to do, especially when it comes to stress, is to retrain our minds. Our minds are so powerful at focusing on negativity, right? We've got a negativity bias. We have way more negative thoughts than we do positive thoughts. And the more that we can step into the innate intelligence of the body, and we can do this with the way that we think, the better our hormone balance. I'll give you a quick example. There's a free app on the iPhone called GPS for the Soul. And I love this app because it uses the technology of heart math, which is where you amplify the positive emotions that come from your heart. You raise your oxytocin levels. And this has been proven to lower your cortisol levels by 23%. It also raises your DHEA levels. So it's a way of improving your stress response, improving your stress resilience by measuring something called your heart rate variability with the camera that's on your iPhone. How cool is that?
That's pretty cool. And what about meditation?
I'm a big fan of meditation. I think all of us need to have an a la carte menu of our top three ways to hit the pause button. You know, I think about the nervous system as being divided into two halves, the sympathetic nervous system, which is like your on button, and your parasympathetic nervous system, which is really your off button, kind of your rest and digest, whereas sympathetic nervous system is fight or flight. We want to have a really good fluid dance between these two halves of the nervous system. And one of the ways you do that is by hitting the pause button. So meditation is a great way to do it. But I can tell you, I have men and women who come to see me and they just roll their eyes when I start talking about meditation or yoga.
Right.
And so I think it's important that we have many options, a long menu of what you can do to hit the pause button. For some people, it's orgasm, it's sex. For other people, they love to talk to a girlfriend for 10 or 15 minutes. We know that that raises oxytocin, which lowers your cortisol level. So there's many different ways to do this. Meditation isn't the only way.
Okay.
And we'll go back to our calls. This is Stephen in Miami. Hi. Stephen, you're up.
Ah, yes. When I listen to programs like this, as a longtime veteran of the Depression Wars, it sounds good, and I don't doubt the credentials. It sounds, however, terribly esoteric in terms of the present system of diagnosis for depression. You're way outside the box, and I don't understand how, you know, I'd like to see how, in addition to publishing a book, how present diagnoses for depression can be raised to the level of sophistication you described. So, for example, you go to your primary physician, and he says, "Well, you need drugs, and a psychiatrist prescribes drugs, so you go to a psychiatrist." We know that's essentially what psychiatrists do today. So you go in, it's a very rich interview, 45 minutes, and bang, you're prescribed something, which may work or may not.
Well, let's let the doctor...
I'd like you to comment on that.
Yes, please do.
Well, I appreciate this question, and I think for the problem of depression, I find that our current approach of just throwing pharmaceuticals at depression is not as effective as I wish it were. So to me, as a physician, I feel like it's my job to look at the evidence. What does the evidence tell us? Well, the evidence tells us that a placebo is actually better than the prescription when you have mild to moderate depression. So I don't think that I'm so far outside of the box. I mean, there are many conventional physicians who agree with this and only use prescription medication such as a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor in somebody with severe depression. But we're also in a situation in our healthcare crisis with, on average, a 7-minute appointment with the primary care provider. And sometimes it's easier to write a prescription than to deal with the root causes. I'm making the case and offering the proof to show that there's some other factors that we want to consider. Now, I don't want to make a claim that all of this is hormonal. I certainly wouldn't say that. I don't want to be overly reductionistic. But I think it's important to look at the evidence and say, okay, if you're depressed, 50% of the time you have high cortisol levels. Why not address the cortisol levels in addition to taking care of you? Now, for some people, that might mean that they go on an antidepressant, and alongside with that, they work on their cortisol. Now, 20% of people are going to have a slow thyroid. I would much rather that person get their thyroid addressed first before going on a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor.
Doctor, other than the rhodiola, and by the way, can you get that at all Whole Foods or health food stores? Or
yes, rhodiola is widely available, and the great thing about Google is it doesn't really matter how you spell it, you'll probably come up with it, but it's spelled R-H-O-D-I-O-L-A. And if we go to Gottfried Protocol Step 1 and look at some of those nutritional gaps that people have with high cortisol, here's some of the things that you can do with how you eat, move, and think. So I mentioned already GPS for the soul. I think that's a great way to manage your cortisol. I think it's also important to look at the type of exercise that you have. I've always been a runner, and running raises your cortisol even further. So I do better with adaptive forms of exercise like yoga and Pilates. That does not raise my cortisol levels. I also started taking phosphatidylserine in my 30s. Phosphatidylserine, or PS. That's been shown in both men and women to lower cortisol levels. Fish oil. Now, many folks have omega-3s in their refrigerator, and yet they may not take it every day. So I'm putting in a plug for fish oil here. It really helps you with managing your cortisol levels.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Cynthia. She's in Miami. Hi.
Yes, hi. My name is Cynthia. I'm a 50-year-old woman with a 14-year-old son and a 12-year-old daughter and a stressful job. And also I have, I'm at very high risk for breast cancer in my family, so I'm very scared of taking any hormone supplements or enhancers. And quite frankly, the only natural supplement and the only way that I've been dealing with it is by smoking marijuana, and I really find I get a lot of, it alleviates a lot of premenstrual, hormonal, and depressive, you know, feelings, and it gives me that time out feeling. I was just wondering, what evidence do you have on your research, and, you know, is it good, is it bad, or, well, not an opinion, but what reference you have for using marijuana to alleviate those symptoms? Mm.
What do you think, doctor?
Well, yeah, thank you, Cynthia. So I have to tell you, I reviewed 2,000 studies for my book, The Hormone Cure, and Not a single one of them is on marijuana. So I do not know the literature on marijuana. I mean, certainly there is anecdotal evidence, but one of the things that happens with evidence, and I think it's really important, especially for women, that we have good evidence for any recommendations that we make. It's very important that we have something called randomized trials, because that is the highest quality evidence that we can have to say that an intervention is effective. I'm not aware of randomized trials looking at some of the issues that women have, such as PMS, and noting a benefit with marijuana, but I'm really not familiar with them. But you mentioned another piece that I think is important that I'm very familiar with, and that is that you're at a high risk for breast cancer.
Yes.
And let's take that on, because it sounds like you're in a stressful job. You've got two kids that you're raising. They're adolescents. I know what it's like to be perimenopausal when you have two adolescents. I have a 13-year-old daughter and an 8-year-old daughter.
Yes, and then an 85-year-old father and an 80-year-old mother.
So you are in that sandwich generation.
And the seniors to take care of.
Yes, well, you're in that sandwich generation where it's overwhelming. It's overwhelming how much you have on your plate. So here's what we know when it comes to breast cancer. We know that there's certain things that can put you at a greater risk. We used to think that breast cancer was when you had one rogue cell in your breast that had a mutation and it would divide into daughter cells and turn into a lump over time. And now we actually think something different. We think that you have rogue cells all the time. And the more that you're creating a good neighborhood in your body where you are minimizing sugar, you're minimizing alcohol, you're eating nutrient-dense foods, you're eating things like kale and broccoli and wild Alaskan salmon, those are things that create a good neighborhood and prevent your risk of cancer. So another point that I want to make, let's just talk about alcohol for a moment. We know that more than 3 to 6 servings of alcohol per week increase the risk of breast cancer, because it makes estrogen do a backflip and turn into the type of estrogen that is harmful for you. So I'm not saying everyone must abstain. I think that's only important if you have alcoholism or a sticky relationship to alcohol. I'm just saying less quantity, better quality.
Another break on today's Topical Currents. We're speaking with Dr. Sarah Gottfried, and the name of the book is The Hormone Cure. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
And it is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. And we continue our conversation with Dr. Sarah Gottfried. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Michelle. She's in Miami also. Hi there.
Hi, good morning, doctor. I wanted to know if you take a look at cortisol levels when diagnosing an increase of prolactin levels. Other than immediately looking at the pituitary, do you also look at the cortisol levels?
Good question. You know, when I see people who have an increase in their prolactin levels, I refer them to an endocrinologist. So, you know, part of what you're referring to is the crosstalk or the interdependence between some of the hormones that women make. And I just want to be honest with you. If I have someone with increased prolactin, and the way that that often shows up is with discharge from the breast, from the nipple, I refer those people to an endocrinologist.
I have only seen the increase in blood levels. I don't have any of the reaction of a high prolactin level.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is where I would defer to an endocrinologist. I'm sorry, I'm not able to offer you more help. I imagine that cortisol might somehow be involved, because prolactin does dance with progesterone, and definitely cortisol and progesterone have quite a bit of cross-reactivity. I mentioned earlier that cortisol can block the progesterone receptor, so that progesterone can't get into its cute little receptor and do its business, which is to calm you down, to help regulate your cycle. But I would defer to an endocrinologist in terms of elevated prolactin levels.
Okay, Michelle, sounds like good advice.
Thank you.
And we move along to Rebecca in Fort Lauderdale. Hi.
Hello?
Rebecca, go ahead.
Yeah. Hi. I find this topic very interesting. I have been on SSRIs since oh gosh, the late 90s. And, you know, they had that poop out effect. The doctor prescribed Adderall as a supplement to help kind of keep it working. And I deal with depression associated with PMS. And I've had 5 miscarriages. And every time I've had a miscarriage, the chromosomal workup has come back totally normal. All of my workup with IVF, with maternal fetal medicine doctors, everything's pretty much normal. My blood pressure does go up and down. It varies. In the past couple of years, I get stressed. So I take baby aspirin. But I'm wondering if the cortisone, I had someone mentioned cortisone levels to me not too long ago relating to miscarriage. Is there any kind of study or reference concerning that?
Yeah. So when it comes to miscarriages, what I think about is both your stress level and your cortisol. And I also think about your progesterone levels. So when I have someone in my practice who has had miscarriages, often they're working with a reproductive endocrinologist, someone who specializes in this, because definitely once you get to 3 miscarriages, I think that is a serious problem that needs to be addressed. What I think is important is to look at those progesterone and cortisol levels. Have you had either one of those tested?
I know I've had my progesterone tested, and the last 2 times they put me on progesterone, not in the beginning of the pregnancy, but then it went down, so they put me on it. And I'm not sure, is cortisol something that they regularly test for? Because I have, you know, been to reproductive endocrinologists and had extensive workups.
Yes, I imagine you've had a lot of blood tests done.
Yeah.
Often cortisol is not one of the tests that they do. And I'm trying to argue in my book to really get more doctors to look at cortisol levels because of this interdependence, this crosstalk between cortisol and progesterone. So because progesterone can be blocked by cortisol, it's very important that we look at your cortisol levels. You also said that you have PMS. We know that women who have PMS definitely have more of an issue with cortisol. When I see someone who's got PMS, I use the Gottfried protocol. So I really start with step 1, what are the nutritional gaps we need to fill in? What are the lifestyle changes? We know that staying off of sugar is very important because women with PMS have about 275% more sugar, more refined carbohydrates than women who don't have PMS. I also find that the B vitamins are very important. And I talk about this in chapter 5 of my book. B1, B2, B6, magnesium is really important. And then step 2 of the Gottfried protocol is to use chasteberry. So there's 5 randomized trials showing that chasteberry is very effective when it comes to PMS. Now, of course, you'd want to work with your local physician on this, especially if you're taking an SSRI. But I think it's important for you to take a look at that cortisol level and to take a look at the progesterone level, because it sounds like, at least with this last pregnancy that you mentioned, that you got started on progesterone because it dropped. And I would wonder if it dropped because of cortisol.
Yeah, so they did test my T4 and TSH, and she said it was a little on the low side, but it was probably just because I was pregnant.
Yeah, so it's interesting. For women who are pregnant, we have a very tight optimal range for where we want the thyroid to be functioning. And I completely agree with that. I think we've got a lot of evidence to show that it's important to have a tighter range, like a more narrow normal range that we use in women who are pregnant. But I also want to say for our other listeners that it's a bit of a double standard. Like, why can't all women have a more tight optimal range when it comes to their thyroid function? So I would say it sounds like you might have some issues with all 3 of the hormonal Charlie's Angels, your thyroid, your cortisol, and then how estrogen is doing the tango with progesterone. And you may want to do some testing, you know, see if your local doctor is willing to look at your cortisol and your thyroid again. And if there's a problem getting some collaboration, you can also self-test for these things. And the labs are listed in my appendix.
Well, doctor, we're almost out of time. Can we go over the websites again, your website and the website for the book and the quiz and all that, please?
Sure. Yes. So the website for the book is thehormonecurebook.com. For the quiz, it's thehormonecurebook.com/quiz. And then my bigger website is sarahgottfriedmd.com.
And there's a lot of information on that as well.
And she's joined us this afternoon from San Francisco. Once again, we want to thank you. It's been a very interesting hour with Dr. Sarah Gottfried, and she's the author of The Hormone Cure, Reclaim Balance, Sleep, Sex Drive, and Vitality Naturally. Thank you very much, Doctor.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And that wraps up today's edition. Apologies to those callers we couldn't get on the air. Our producer is Richard Ive. Technical director is Caroline Brader Watson. Paul Leary is online producer. You can check out free audio archives and program downloads at our website. That's WLRN.org. Also, more information, discussions, photos, and more at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Please drop us a like. Tomorrow we visit with London-based activist and journalist David Graeber. He's written The Democracy Project, A History, A Crisis, A Movement. Now the calendar. On this day in 1863, 150 years ago, the birth of newspaper magnate William Randolph Hearst in San Francisco. His millionaire father, George Hearst, won the San Francisco Examiner as payment for a gambling debt. Of course, Hearst's granddaughter is Patty. And on this day in 1946, 67 years ago, the birth of cult film director John Waters in Baltimore. When a kid, he created violent puppet shows. He also owns a painting by serial killer John Wayne Gacy. Pink Flamingos, Polyester, Female Trouble, Hairspray, Desperate Living. One more while we head to 129 West 81st Street, Apartment 5A. On this day in 1955, 58 years ago, the birth of Jerry Seinfeld in Brooklyn. He credits the Abbott and Costello show, the 1950s, as the inspiration for his Seinfeld sitcom. We leave with a thought from John Waters, who cast former teen idol Tab Hunter in the film Hairspray. Quote, "I'd love to sell out completely. It's just that nobody has been willing to buy." This is Joseph Cooper. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation, also for Bonnie Berman.